This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wild lands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we are interviewing Dr. Ron Sutherland. He's the chief scientist for Wildlands Network, and he lives in Durham, North Carolina. Ron is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, and he has his PhD from Duke University in the School of the Environment. So welcome, Ron. It's good to be talking with you today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So tell us about your background and how you came to work for Wildlands Network.
Sure. So I grew up chasing snakes and other wildlife in North Carolina and on family trips down to Florida and all kinds of interesting wildlife down there. And I went off to did my undergrad in biology and then conservation biology and for master's and more biology stuff for PhD. But before, I kind of made the turn towards conservation when, like, basically every forest that I was familiar with in the fast-growing suburb of Raleigh called Cary, North Carolina, all this forest got destroyed to make room for houses, and I got it in my head pretty early on that we needed to do more to save wild places for nature. So that was pretty formative, if sad, for me, and so kind of it's been driving me ever since. And did my PhD looking at the impacts of urbanization on wildlife, especially reptiles and amphibians, but other species too, in this longleaf pine realm of North Carolina called the Sandhills. And then kind of finished that in 2009 and jumped fairly quickly into working for Wildlands Network. And, my advisor was on the board, which certainly helped make that connection. But I really admired the work of Wildlands Network. It was, we were formerly called Wildlands Project.
Uh-huh.
And, the group had always been known for thinking big and being slightly unapologetic about thinking big about the needs of wildlife when it came to protecting natural lands and envisioning a future in which natural lands were protected across North America. So that was really attractive to me, so I was very happy to get a job doing what I wanted to do. And my focus at the start was on the Southeast, and kind of grew a program from there. And now I'm looking, in theory, at the entire continent, which is pretty daunting.
So what's the mission of Wildlands Network? What are they designed to accomplish?
The current mission is basically to reconnect, restore, and rewild nature across North America so that life and all of its diversity can thrive. In practice, that means that we do take that the really big picture perspective, continental perspective, about where and how connections need to be made, wildlife corridors, and then wildlife crossings across roads. So we've been doing lots of work both on the ground in terms of field projects and research, but also in policy work. We've made excellent strides pushing for habitat connectivity policy improvements at the state and federal level. So we're trying to kind of stitch the continent back together, Mexico, United States, Canada, trying to put back the pieces, in places it's definitely a restoration job that needs to happen, and in places it's more protection. That, we've got some really amazing natural areas, especially out in the western parts of the continent, but in the east as well. And so there's just a great need to keep it all together, keep it cohesive, and think about trying to meet, Edward O. Wilson's charge of trying to protect half of nature in order to save 90% of the species.
How did Wildlands Network come to be?
Seriously.
Who put Wildlands together?
It was a group of conservation scientists, like Michael Soule, I think was one of the core leaders, and then some activist-minded people, including Dave Foreman, who is famous for thinking about the big outside across the West and everything, and identifying wilderness areas and so forth. And so that sort of marriage of advocacy and science was what started it off right in the early 90s. And, at the time, nobody was really thinking, at least in the U.S., they were some of the only people that were thinking about large-scale linkages and really mega corridors, trying to protect large connected networks of habitat.
So I know you have staff members and all the way across across the United States. You have some staff members down in Mexico. Do you also have staff members in Canada?
We do. It's been a long time coming, but we actually have one staff member who's based in Canada. She's not doing program work at the moment. We've had some great Canadian board members, and I think we're looking forward to jumping through some of the hurdles that are involved in working in a tri-national basis. The legal hurdles are fairly interesting and intricate. It's not quite part of my job to figure those out, but we have a long history of some great partnerships with some Canadian conservationists, and so we're looking forward to keeping those going.
So the website says you coordinate science programs for Wildlands Network. That sounds like a big job. What's involved in it?
Oh, I mean, it's definitely my dream job. I get to do a healthy mix of field work, including my own projects. I've been working on this camera trapping effort on red wolves down in eastern North Carolina since 2015. And so that's a piece of my job I really like, because I get to go down there and see the wolves and work in that environment. And then we've got road ecology projects in the mountains of North Carolina on Interstate 40. We've had a nice road project here in Durham that I ran. And then other road projects in California and New Mexico, kind of scattered, and down in Mexico itself, we have some road projects on Highway 2 down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we're trying to the road projects are aimed at identifying the best ways of getting wildlife across a given stretch of road,
mm-hmm.
or identifying the piece of the road that's most important to mitigate in terms of where do we want to put a wildlife crossing across a given interstate where it crosses this big natural area, like Great Smoky Mountains National Park and I-40. We did a lot of work there trying to figure out where the interstate could use some new wildlife crossings.
So do you work with all of the staff in this, your scientifically oriented staff who are doing research?
Yeah. And we have some dedicated core staff for science. My colleague Liz Hillard in North Carolina, and Alex Banco, who's our GIS mapper guy, and then Aaron Faca out in New Mexico. Aaron and Liz are both PhDs, like me, and doing some really interesting research at all kinds of different projects, really. But then I get to work with other staff too, in terms of the program work and policy work we're doing, sort of weighing in on the science side of those things as well. So,
does your job require a lot of travel?
Well, not in this age of Zoom and everything else. It's not as much travel as maybe it would have used to require. But last year I did get out. Kind of emerging from the pandemic, I got to go down to New Mexico and Arizona and down into Mexico on one trip, and then I got to go up to California to see our Highway 395 project and up into Washington, looking at Interstate 5, where it kind of cuts across, actually Oregon and California, that we're looking at Washington too with Interstate 5, I-5. I think I can keep it to a relatively balanced number of trips, but yeah. At the same time, I realize that it's a really huge continent with an incredible diversity of natural habitats, and as one person, I can't do justice for all of it. But our staff is growing, and we're getting more and more capacity to work in different places. So that's fun.
What's the project on I-5 in Northern California?
It's just getting started, and it's not just us. It's a collaborative of different groups are starting to look at how to kind of take a whole highway perspective, because I-5 really stretches along the Pacific Coast there and crosses a lot of important habitats, and so there's just a lot of different opportunities for wildlife mitigation along I-5, and nobody's really taken that holistic look across the entire stretch of highway. So we're working with a bunch of different partners to try to get that project kick-started there.
Are you looking at wildlife movement across the highway?
Yeah, that's part of it, is sort of looking at specific animals. Yeah, when we get to that point, sort of where a given species that might be a target species, where are they crossing the highway? Also, where to, at a kind of a structural sense, where do we have large, important connections, like in Northern California, Southern Oregon, there's a really important east-west connection there between the kind of the Pacific ranges and the Sierra and the Cascades. And that area, I-5 goes right through the middle of it, so it's structurally important for connectivity, for habitat, for a lot of wildlife.
So habitat connectivity mapping is one of your responsibilities. Tell us a little more about that. What's the purpose of mapping on habitat connectivity?
Yeah, so Wildlands Network was actually one of the early groups to jump into the idea of regional scale maps of how, we called them Wildlands Network designs. They were kind of core corridors, hub spoke type mapping things, and we did those for a number of regions in the West, and then also for the Northern Appalachians. And then when I started, I started with the idea of doing a similar design for the Southeast, but it kind of turned into this idea that we could map the what we call the entire Eastern Wildway. So this sort of grand vision of how you could reconnect nature across Eastern North America, forward all the way up to Quebec. And so I kind of put some time into that back starting in 2016. And by 2019 or so, we had a nice edition of a map that we were really proud of. And we printed out 1,000 copies of a kind of an art poster version of it. And it's meant to inspire people, especially on the East Coast. We need that inspiration to be able to think about, the future is still possible, that we can still reconnect all these different places.
So once you've done the mapping, what do you do with that information in order to improve connectivity of wildlife?
Well, we try to get it in the hands of the right people. Wildlands Network, we're larger than we used to be, but we're still quite realistic about how the scale of the issue across the continent. So, but there's so many great land trusts in working in the East in particular, and so many great other conservation partners out West. And so what we're trying to do is get these maps in the hands of the right folks and get them to use them. And it's happening. There's some land trusts in North Carolina that are using the Wildway to sort of help justify protecting a particular corridor of land up in the mountains in North Carolina. Same thing, I think, is happening up in New York. So that's the idea. And I think, it also works just in the larger sense. Our work at Wildlands Network and at Wildlands Project before that has helped move the needle to where everyone is now talking about these large-scale networks of habitat for biodiversity. And so that's been an important role for us as well, not just as the ones making our own maps, but also people who have really, really, really catalyzed the movement to be in a better position here. So,
another part of your job is called road ecology. How is that distinguished from the habitat connectivity? And what is road ecology? Why are you engaged in it?
So, road ecology is the science of trying to understand the impacts of roads on ecosystems and wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty intricately connected with the idea of habitat connectivity. The way I sort of separate it is that, connectivity can include things like a corridor of land that it has habitat and ecosystems on it, and you're trying to get the flow of animals going. But then roads are one of the key barriers that can interrupt the flow of wildlife across the landscape. And so if we're going to work on habitat connectivity, we almost by definition have to be working on getting animals across roads.
Right.
And that's definitely a key part of my job. We do a lot of work on that.
Are you engaged in promoting safe highway crossings for wildlife?
Yes. Yeah. No, that we were one of the groups that helped push really hard for the $350 million for the pilot program, the Wildlife Crossings pilot program that was in President Biden's infrastructure bill a couple years ago. And so we helped secure that, and now a lot of states are applying or just applied for the first round of that money.
Uh-huh.
And then we're, the projects like that Interstate 40 project in the Pigeon River Gorge in North Carolina, or our 395 project, we're trying to identify these places where crossings need to be built. And that's kind of on the science side. And then on the sort of policy and advocacy side, we want to actually make sure these things get built and they get funded. Funding is a huge limiting factor right now because the demand, we kind of just realized that the demand for wildlife crossings is much, much greater than the available amount of funding at the moment.
Right.
They're super effective and cost effective. They save quite a bit of money in terms of property damage and human injuries and the wildlife costs and things like that as well. The challenge is, society benefits and the wildlife benefits, but who's going to pay for it? That's what we're still trying to figure out.
Those crossings, I think the bridges run around $5 million a piece. Is that the average cost?
Yeah, for overpasses, they can be pretty expensive. They do pay for themselves over time if they're put in the right place, and that's another key reason why our science is so important.
Yeah.
But underpasses don't have to be that expensive. It can be a large culvert, for example, that goes under a road, and a lot of animals will use that if you can put it in. And when a road is being redone anyway, like repaved or widened to an extra lane or something like that, then you can put in, you can kind of upgrade the existing culvert system. Usually there's some culverts already for creeks and things, and you can really just go in and upgrade those for not that much money.
Okay, well, let's talk about the recovery of the red wolf population in North Carolina. Where are they located, and what's going on? What do you do there?
Sure. So all of the red wolves that currently exist in the wild that we know of, they all live in the northeastern corner of North Carolina on what's called the Albemarle Peninsula. If you ever see a map of North Carolina and you're familiar with the Outer Banks, the little ribbon of sand that goes along the outside edge, and then inland from that there's a peninsula that sort of sticks out into the Outer Banks, and that's the Albemarle Peninsula. And they chose that as a reintroduction site for the red wolf because it was actually basically going extinct in the wild back in the 60s and 70s. It was the original wolf of the southeast, but it was wiped out on the Atlantic side by like 1900. And then a few of the wolves survived on the Gulf Coast and then the Mississippi River Valley. And the Fish and Wildlife Service, even before they started the Endangered Species Act, the precursor to the Endangered Species Act, they declared the red wolf endangered. And they set out to try to save it. And they realized that they only had a few animals left. In fact, when they caught the wolves, they only ended up with, I think, 17 animals, of which only 14 were convinced to breed in captivity. Mm-hmm. And those 14 animals sort of founded the catu population, and then that was used. By 1987, they were ready to reintroduce them in the wild in North Carolina. So they chose that area. Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge is at least by East Coast standards, quite a wildlife spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
That we've seen close to 40 black bears, actually a little over 40 black bears, in 2 days of driving around there. And it's been the home of the wolves since 1987, and we've been trying to work on that ever since.
What's the population number now, and is it stable, or is it...
That's a great question. So the red wolf population grew from 87 to about 2006, 2012, got up to about 120 animals, and things were going pretty well, and then some political shifts happened. And this one real estate developer who happened to have a lot of money on hand took it on himself. He got mad at the Red Wolf program for no clear reason. And he kind of took it on as a pet project that he was going to try to destroy the Red Wolf recovery program. He went around spreading rumors that the wolves were eating all the other wildlife, all the deer and wild turkey and things. And that got people shooting the wolves. And the population crashed, and it happened to coincide with the time when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service just wasn't doing, they weren't in a position of wanting to stand up for their wolf programs very much.
Uh-huh.
And so essentially the Red Wolf program collapsed almost to the verge of extinction again. It got down to about 11 animals by 2020 and 2021. And then finally, new administration took over. And they have kind of recommitted themselves to trying to grow the population again. And they've released some more animals from captivity and gotten the population back up to about 30 animals in the wild right now, is my understanding. So it's been a real roller coaster, and it's really sad that so much effort, because it's a huge amount of effort, went into getting that population of 120 animals. There's nobody really knows why the wolves didn't take off. Even more robustly, like the gray wolves that jumped up to 1,000 animals pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I've got my guesses. I think part of it was starting with just 14 animals that were probably already kind of related to each other. Whereas with the gray wolves, they were able to use a very healthy, healthy genes pool up in Canada to bring down a bunch of wolves that way, and I think that helped. And then the red wolf also has to contend with its sort of smaller sister species, the coyote. Red wolves are not nearly as big as gray wolves, and our coyotes are bigger on the East Coast than they are out west. And so the red wolf is also kind of hemmed in a little bit still by coyotes, and it takes a while for them to push away the coyote population. So
the population in the wild now is around, did you say 20?
I think it's around 30 or so.
And then there's still a breeding population that's in captivity, is that right?
Yeah. Fortunately, the species does breed fine in captivity. There's about 250 animals scattered at over 40 different sites around,
really?
Around the country. Which is great, and the captive breeding program has been what has saved the species. But there's been kind of a tendency in recent years to sort of focus too much energy, I think, on promoting the captive population and treating the captive population like it's the it's what matters. And you know, from my perspective, there's a lot of work to do to actually promote the recovery of the species in the wild, which is what the Endangered Species Act mandates, is recovery in the wild and not sort of indefinitely maintaining the animal in captivity. So it's good we have the captive population, but we need to get the animal back out there across the southeast.
What projects or activities are your staff working on down in Mexico?
In Mexico, we have a mix of things. Some road ecology projects. Yeah, I mentioned Highway 2, which is it's like an interstate highway that cuts just south of the border. In fact, for a lot of Highway 2, you can see the border wall, which is another issue we work on.
Mm-hmm.
The border wall itself is a barrier to connectivity. But we, you know, we realize that the Highway 2 is a busy highway that's got lots of truck traffic, is a barrier for wildlife in and of itself. And so we've been doing roadkill surveys and culvert surveys along that highway to see where animals are trying to cross, where they're getting hit, and trying to ultimately to look again at, you know, where we could put interventions in, where we can improve the situation for wildlife. And we've been expanding that to some other highways further south in Sonora. Really, our work in Mexico is largely focused in the northwestern corner, our field work anyways, in the state of Sonora in particular. We also have some policy programs based out of Mexico City, but target species, we have a strong emphasis on thinking about jaguar connectivity, for example, and ocelots, where we're trying to work with all kinds of partners to try to promote the flow of big animals, like, you know, big cats like the jaguars and ocelots, across that landscape. And with the hope, ultimately, at least on our side, on the U.S. side, with the hope that those animals can continue to expand back into the United States where they used to occur. And so the conservation situation in Mexico is very different than it is in the U.S. They have way fewer formal protected areas, and the land ownership is, in that part of Mexico at least, is much more communal. It's based on this ejido system of sort of communal land ownership, and so it's just a different ball game down there in terms of what's possible for conservation. But we're doing our best to keep that going.
Okay, well, Ron, we've run out of time, but I really appreciate your talking to us today. It's been very interesting, and I look forward to doing some more with members of your staff. So thank you very much. Our guest today has been Dr. Ron Sutherland. He's the chief scientist for the Wildlands Network. Ron is located in Durham, North Carolina. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.